You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, April 21st, 2010. This is episode 128, Backups, iPads, and Other Fun. Welcome back to the Wells Tech Podcast. My name is Martin Spriggs, Synod's Chief Technology Officer and your Wells Tech host. Been with you for 128 episodes, and joining me for almost every one of those now, Sally, is Sally Draper. Hi, Sally.
Good morning, Martin, and I'm sending out some birthday wishes your direction.
Oh,
this
it's
week.
Long past now. It's a day behind us. Thank you very much.
I think Facebook has become the big birthday party place
these days. Facebook is such a wonderful tool in most circumstances, except when it's your birthday.
Except when you want to slip that past.
That's right, and that's impossible. Yeah, absolutely. So, and we have a special guest in studio today who we've had on the show before, Rob Benson, and what you call, Sally, the techie extraordinaire.
That's right.
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Rob is our, what do we call you around? What's your official title?
Network or security
something.
Yeah,
administrator. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. He's kind of our go-to guy if something isn't working or something's down. So he gets to field a lot of happy people's questions, right?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Okay.
Fireman, I think, is actually.
Fireman, yes. So, depending on the size of the problem, that's the size hose you use. So we're glad he's. You've been with us for what? About 4 years now.
Five years.
Yeah,
yikes. Just finished up five.
So, well, happy anniversary.
Thanks.
By the way, so he's still here after 5 years. We haven't scared him off. So, well, the reason we have Rob on is we felt that it would be a great topic to have Rob on for, and that's the concept of, novel concept for some, of backups, right? Whether it be personal or organizational. And I think the last time we had you on, Rob, we talked about security, virus protection. Mm-hmm. But no less important is backup, and something that, you know, a lot of people say they should do, you know, and have good intentions, especially around the first of the year with resolutions, but it's just not the most glamorous thing, is it?
No.
So Rob is tasked with that here in the Synod office, but has lots of expertise that we'd love for him to share with the audience. And we've gotten requests in the past, Sally, from our listeners about, you know, what are some best practices for backup? So now is the time, right?
Yeah, you know, Martin, I guess I'm going to be the representative bad segment of the listening audience that doesn't do proper backups. So I'm here to be educated by you, Rob, and motivated as to why we should be doing this and what's the dead easiest way to do it for free if possible. So hopefully you're gonna share that with us. One quick mention for our listening audience, those that were tuned in last week, this was going to be book discussion week, Martin, and you broke my heart and told me that we couldn't talk about
right.
My favorite book today.
Yeah, so we'll postpone that to a later episode. So anybody that had prepped for this show and read the chapter, sorry about that. But We did a little preemptive strike for you, Sally.
Yeah.
And so now you're going to sit at the feet of the master, Rob
right.
Benson, and learn. So let's start off with maybe a very basic question, Rob. Why, you know, why don't people or organizations back up like they should?
Well, I think with organizations, it's difficult to identify what to back up, and that's why they don't back up like they should. They don't really take stock of what their users are working with and which segment of that really needs to be protected. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of lack of communication between IT departments and users. And I also think that end users just don't really listed on their they don't have it on their list of really important things to do. I think Sally said, you know, what's going to motivate me? And I think the most motivating point for backups is your hard drive will fail. It's not if your hard drive will fail. Your hard drive will eventually fail.
In fact, like the manufacturer tells you that, yes, right? They list it right on the drive.
They tell you roughly when they think it might fail. Right. Yeah, it could last, you know, a very long time, but it will eventually fail. 100,000 years from now, it will not be here. So
maybe even 5 years from now. Yes.
A year from now sometimes.
Yes. Yep.
So, and if you drop it, it most certainly will fail sooner, mm-hmm. if not immediately. So it's very important to back up. And I just don't think that people understand that until it's too late.
And it back in the day, you know, and this is not too long ago, backup was such a pain to do. You know, regardless of the operating system. I know when I had my iMac, there weren't great backup solutions. Certainly not that came with it. I mean, there was a little tool that you could get with your Mobile Me account, which was, you know, kind of a pitiful excuse. Microsoft has it was no better, right?
Yeah, it was command line at that time.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but that all has changed. I think there are much better tools. Microsoft's backup solution is much better with Windows 7, and a Time Machine on the Mac operating system makes it pretty easy as well. So, no excuses. Now, the next big question is, you talked a little bit about trying to identify what needs to be backed up. How often should you back up?
Well, it depends on how important a thing is to you and mm-hmm. how often you update it. We've got some stuff that we actually only back up when we do an update. A mm-hmm. lot of our Linux boxes are backed up that way because mm-hmm. They don't change. But if you have photos that you import constantly or you have documents that you need updated, you might need it done daily. Mm-hmm. I'd say that you default to a week. A weekly backup, maybe a Saturday night or a Sunday night when you're not working on the computer, that you should really dedicate to that.
Right.
And work from there. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll find out you only need it once a month. Maybe you need it every day. But start with a week. That's a good, solid set point.
Yep. And with the tools of today, there's not a lot of harm in doing it more often. Storage is fairly cheap. And some of the tools are very automated, so it's not that you have to click a button every time, you know, you need to back up. So it's almost a matter of how much are you willing to lose.
Yeah.
You know, how much can you afford to lose, and how much do you want to recreate?
Yeah, and web-based backup solutions, those are pretty much consistent now. I mean, that's just basically a constant backup.
Right.
And that makes it really thought-free.
Right. So a lot of our listeners are managers of the infrastructure for a church or a school. And usually these are fairly smallish networks. Mm-hmm. They're not sophisticated. They're pretty manual in their management. What's the best solution? Maybe the best backup tool to use in an environment like that?
If you're a small organization with limited budget, which is pretty much everybody these days. You can just use Microsoft's built-in backup utility with a USB drive. Honestly, it's free. It's there. It doesn't require much configuration, and it's very inexpensive to buy some USB drive and back up to it. The important thing is to get into the habit of backing up, not so much what you're using to do it. If you've got a semi-complicated organization and money is a real problem for you, an open source solution like Amanda might mm-hmm. be able to help you. It's cross-platform, and the base model of it's absolutely free to use, even for an organization.
How does that work? GPL. Does it run as a service, or it probably runs in different forms
it has
on
clients.
Different operating systems?
Yeah, it okay. actually has clients on each of the operating systems that's centralized backup, a lot like Yosemite or Backup Exec.
And it'll back up to what?
Anything, even the Amazon Cloud, it'll back up to.
The S3 tool, yeah. Right, okay.
It'll even back up to that, but tape drives as well. Very flexible.
Rob, just want to back up a second. When you say the Microsoft backup with the USB drive, is that specific to a certain version of the Microsoft operating system, or are there backup utilities that are worthy, you know, even in XP, which I know a lot of our congregations are still running, or in Vista or Windows 7?
It's actually there in XP, and it's very good. In fact, for this, I just wanted to test and make sure it would back up to my flash drive before I recommended it, and sure enough, it did. So it's actually darn easy to use. You use it with the scheduler that's built into XP, and it's really quite good.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're not talking about backing up everything. And I think that can be kind of overwhelming if you say, well, I got to back up every file on my computer. And with today's operating systems, that's a huge task and probably not needed, right?
Right. In most cases, it's not needed. Generally, there are people who actually do what's called a clone of a machine. And there's cases where you might want to do that. But generally, if you have a failure, it's best to rebuild the machine.
Right.
And then bring back the files that you need.
Reinstall the operating system from the disk or from the restore partition,
whatever. Right. It's cleaner. It's faster. It's just, well, it's not faster to do, but it's a faster machine when you get done.
So some amount of file management or discipline is necessary so that you're actually putting the files you want in a consistent location, like My Documents or something like that, as opposed to scattered around, you know, the hard drive. So that makes backing up or configuring the backup tool a little bit easier. So you'll point it at a folder or series of folders, as opposed to, you know, not knowing where everything is. So you got to back everything up.
I think it's best even to, because My Documents stores a lot of stuff that you really don't even know is being stored there.
Mm-hmm.
It's often best to make a subdirectory under the My Documents. It's just named backup.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know exactly what you are backing up, and you don't get a bunch of stuff that you wonder what the heck this is when you're recovering it, or maybe a setting that you didn't want to recover.
Right. And with some of the media tools of the day, like iTunes and you know, some of the photo managers, you're going to want to make sure you capture those areas as well, right?
Mm-hmm. And it, by the way, be flexible. I mean, your iPod, that's a legitimate backup of your photos if you have all your photos on it, and it can come back.
Okay.
Okay, so Rob, we've also heard a lot about off-site and cloud-based backup. You guys mentioned that earlier, and, you know, how secure is that? Is that an option we should be considering, or should we you know, include offsite automatically just to make sure our data is secure if there's some kind of disaster or whatever?
Well, with everything, reading the agreement is the most important thing. They're long and they're tedious. and if you really don't understand what you're reading, it's best to look up reviews on the specific to the agreement that you're making with whatever on-site service you're using. There are some that actually take ownership of documents that you create. So you have to be very careful with that.
So that's what you've been doing all those 5 years that you've been down there in the basement in an administration building, just reading those agreements.
That's all I do. Yeah, I just basically read agreements, and that's why I pretty much say no almost all the time.
That's right.
Don't want to think about it.
That's right. So what kind of tools are we talking about that you're aware of, these cloud-based solutions?
Oh, we were just using one. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But, you know,
Carbonite.
Carbonite. I'm actually in love with Carbonite.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it. Dropbox itself actually now has an actual backup utility.
Oh, really?
Built into
it,
supposedly,
a lot of people
that will synchronize.
Dropbox, yeah.
And that's completely valid as a backup utility.
Okay.
I've been using Google Docs because I use a lot of different devices of different operating systems.
Right.
And I just basically have a copy that goes off to there.
And you've got, 25 gigs there now? Is that right?
You know,
whatever
sure.
Your
I don't
Google
even meet
allocation
close
is.
Close to that. I use maybe 500 megs, if that.
Yep.
And that's pretty bad, honestly.
Yeah, and I've mentioned in the past that I use Backblaze, which is about $50 a year. What I like about Backblaze is it'll actually read externally connected drives. So I've got a little Seagate drive that I house some photos and stuff on, kind of home stuff, and it goes out and grabs that as well. It takes a long time for the initial backup. I think all of them do, but once it's done, you really don't have to do much else. It just kind of works in the background. As long as the service is running, you're in good shape.
Yeah, the cloud-based backups are really excellent for small organizations, too. Mm-hmm. Larger ones, you start getting into traffic control problems.
Right.
Some of them are pretty smart about handling the traffic control problems, mm-hmm. but some of them will really jam up your network. Another good thing about those cloud-based things is they can be a good replacement for a tape. If
right.
you don't have an amazing amount of data,
right.
way better than a tape because you don't need to maintain that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of my questions. I'm getting into over my head territory here and just making sure I understand. If I do the cloud-based thing, do I need to do the hardware-based backup as well? You know, have the external drive that I'm backing up to as well? Do you recommend a redundancy with your backups, or is one good enough?
I recommend redundancy. Do both.
Somehow I knew you would say that.
I'm huge for this.
Over my head.
But here's the deal. If you're going to choose one, if your house burns down, your web-based backup didn't burn with it. Mm-hmm. But I guarantee your USB drive just did.
Right.
So yep. that's the way to go.
Now, the cloud-based is a little bit slower. Plus, retrieval is going to be slower as well, because
mm-hmm.
if you know it's going to have to download it, or with the case of Backblaze, they can actually send you a DVD or a disk. So if it's something you really need back right away, that would be maybe a reason that you'd do the local backup as well as the cloud-based one. And it's never a bad idea, because then you could actually use a cloud-based to back up the backup. So you've got a kind of a three-tier approach, and if you do an accidental deletion, there may be a chance that you could retrieve that file too. So what's the difference? A lot of people are thinking that backup is the be-all end-all, but I've also used syncing software that kind of does the same thing, right?
They're similar.
Yep. So what's better? What's the difference?
Well, neither's better. They're for different things. But the best, well, I'll explain what they are first, and then I'll go into what the best solution is. A backup is basically a one-way thing. You write a backup to a remote device. With synchronization, the device can write back to you. So basically, if you had two computers,
right.
you would only have to have basically one set of files between the two of them, but it would be redundant. In other words, there would be a copy on Dave's computer and
right.
a copy on Bill's computer.
Right.
Therefore, basically, you've got a backup. That's really pretty great, and it's current all the time.
Tools like like Dropbox would
That's
be an example of something
right.
that you could sync. Or we've talked about SugarSync before that does something similar.
Yeah, now Dropbox, that does snapshotting every
right.
once in a while, revisioning.
Right.
And that's kind of the flaw in synchronization, because not all of it does versioning.
Okay.
If you don't have versioning, then if you miswrite a file, in other words, you save your doc accidentally with a shopping list, now you've just done it to your backup, too.
Right.
So basically the best thing to do is synchronization with backups. Basically a snapshot that's taken every once in a while, so you can go a week back.
And do some revisions, get some revisions, right?
Right.
Yep.
Revisioning is pretty great, but that's actually based on a number, usually.
Right.
You can say 5 revisions,
yep.
and you might need something from half a year ago, and the backup will do that. So a combination of the two is awesome.
Yep. Very good.
The backup will do that if you don't write over the backup.
Yeah, if you store, different, exactly. Okay. I think that's what you meant.
Right. right. And usually backups are, based on versioning, keeping them for a certain distance of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the software is going to do that for you automatically?
Yes. If it's
depending
told to,
on how you set it up.
Yeah, so you've got full backups, you've got incrementals that basically will do the same thing, too. So you're not, so you're doing a full backup every so often, and then you're running incrementals.
Right.
That don't need to do the whole thing, but then you get the advantage of being able to go back in time and say, grab the file as it was on a month ago.
And for you home users, we're using these terms like incremental that are kind of scary, but really it's transparent.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. You just know you have a backup from a week ago, and
right.
you can pull it up.
Right.
It's really, even especially with the Macs,
with
their
time machine
is
right.
insane.
Yeah, I mean, you can go back and say,
really
give me the
great.
File as it existed 2 months ago.
Yeah, and it shows little pictures of
right.
of it for you. I mean, that's really nice tech.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so you've been talking more oriented toward organizations, churches, and schools. Does the same apply to individuals as far as your software selections that you would recommend?
No. No. For home users, that Dropbox is great. There is a lot of free software to get you hooked on the idea of synchronization with a remote website or, you know, cloud-based backups. Those are really, really awesome for home users because they're free, they're easy to use, and they back up for you so you don't have to think about it. Also note that almost every USB drive now comes with some type of backup software that's at least fairly easy to use.
Yeah, they usually call them easy backup or one-click backup or something like that.
Yeah, I love the one-button
backups.
Those are really
neat. Yeah, Seagate does that, don't they? Right.
And MacStore used to do that, too. Okay. That one-button backup.
Yep.
But that's really great stuff.
Okay.
For home users, though, prioritizing really applies to make sure what's really important to you and make sure that's what you're backing up. Don't try to back up everything.
Yep. Probably a good idea to check your backups, too. So you could be running along for a couple of years happy as a clam, but you know, you're never backing up what you thought you'd back up until you know everything crashes and you want your family photos from 20 years ago and you can't get them.
Yeah. And boy, you're not a family hero anymore.
Right.
When that happens, you
That's
know?
Right. You are
so
not.
So do you guys have success stories like that where you have been able to retrieve something important?
Yeah. Oh, we do here at the SAB. We do it almost every week now.
Yep. Yep. I had something I was using, and I still do use Prezi for some presentations. We've talked about that on the show in the past, and they have kind of a quirky, buggy desktop component. It's a cloud-based solution, but you can download them to the desktop, and I did all kinds of desktop work. And something happened, you know, at some point, and I was only a couple days away from having to give the presentation, and I was looking at probably 2 or 3 days worth of rework, and, you know, because of Backblaze, basically, I was able to grab a previous version and get to a point where I didn't have to reinvent the wheel that I'd spent, you know, probably 20 hours on in the meantime. So it was, boy.
Every dollar spent on Backblaze was well worth it that
right
day.
Right, just there, yes. I would have paid $50 just for that, yes.
All right.
So I'm sure Rob can recount endless tales about backups that have really saved office workers here for sure.
Oh, yeah. And having a good backup, knowing you have a good backup, really reduces on pit of the stomach fears. You can tell, by the way, if I know I have a good backup, I'm real cocky about it. And if I'm quiet and looking kind of nervous in the corner, you know, something wasn't going right that week.
Yeah, so Rob's been a hero and a goat, probably.
Yeah, it's probably been times.
That's right. So, all right, so that's backups. If you've got experiences on backups, let us know them, and we'd love to post those in the show notes or in future shows as well. I think everybody's got a different approach to backup, so there's no one good solution other than do it. Make sure you are doing backups. So, all right, let's move on to our ministry resources section. I ran across a great resource on a blog called Church Crunch, and they've been running a series of articles on creating a Facebook page for your ministry. They came out with part two not too long ago. Part one is easy to grab from that same page. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. But a lot of churches are trying to figure out, should my church have a Facebook page? And there are different tools and different ways to do it. I think Facebook is getting more complicated, you know, with each passing day as they've come out with fan pages and group pages and personal pages and all kinds of tools that the industry is adding to Facebook on a daily basis that you can use. And that's good news for good and bad news for churches. It's kind of a complicated landscape at this point, but these articles do a nice job at identifying, you know, the 10 things that would make a nice complement to or necessary components to a church Facebook page. And I think I've said this before, Sally, I think the best use of a Facebook page for churches, not for evangelistic purposes, although there's probably benefit there, but for internal or intranet kinds of communications. Getting your members to join a Facebook page, I think, simplifies the communications chain and brings folks closer together.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that, Martin. We've definitely seen those kind of results here at St. John's. I'm looking over this blog post from Church Crunch that we're going to include in the show notes. And the thing I really like about it, having set up a couple of Facebook pages, is that they give you a ton of screenshots to go by, you know, with these
right.
arrows pointing at exactly what you need to mm-hmm. do. And the thing about Facebook is when you read the options on the screen, they aren't always as intuitive.
Yeah.
You know, as you're setting these things up. And it also seems like it's like a one-shot kind of deal. If you don't do it exactly right, you aren't real comfortable that you're going to be able to get back in there and make changes to it. For instance, when you give your Facebook page a short URL, a fan name
right.
kind of thing. We have facebook.com/WellsTech. If you get confused a little bit, you may be giving that name to your personal Facebook account or something. It's just not always the most intuitive. And so I'm really liking these screenshots they have here. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially if I wanted to create something similar to what they've done, it's almost like a one-shot deal. I'd have to take screenshots as I went, and I wouldn't be sure I was doing it exactly right as I did it.
Right.
So I think this is a real valuable resource.
I found that you kind of have to be in Facebook for a while to understand their language.
Yep.
What do you mean by this,
and
what do you mean by that? So it's not easy for the congregation member or whoever the webmaster is or whoever's got the idea of getting on Facebook to craft this thing from scratch without kind of understanding and kind of being a Facebook geek already. So I guess I would encourage people to get comfortable there and then begin. And that's probably a good idea, too. You definitely need to understand what Facebook is all about before you understand how it could be best used for a ministry purpose.
So this is going to help you do that.
Yep, it's a good article.
Good stuff.
Good stuff, yep. Let's go on to news in tech, Sally.
Yeah, pretty dominant on the news scene lately in technology has been just people beginning to use their iPads.
Yes.
Obviously, the new interactive netbook alternative.
Mm-hmm.
The internet in your hands in a small format. It can be your ebook reader. It certainly can keep up with contacts. You can watch movies on there. You can pretty much do it all on the iPad.
Well, according to Apple, you can, yes.
Yeah, at least according to Apple. They were released on Saturday, April 3rd. Hey, has your son managed to get his hands on one?
No, well, he handles it every time he goes into work, but he does not own one.
Not an owner yet.
No.
But actually, we do know a couple of Wells Techers that are owners, and we got a really great review via email from our friend Perry Lund. He is in Oskaloosa, Iowa,
mm-hmm.
a member of Grace Lutheran Church there, and he took the time to tell us his thoughts on the iPad, and
yep.
real thorough. We really appreciate, Perry, you sending this in.
And we have, Sally, a real live iPad right in my office right now.
Oh, boy. Making your son jealous there. Making me jealous.
Not
there.
Mine, but Rob has one. He's holding it up now.
Okay.
So I've touched it before. He's actually customized it. So if, obviously we're not a video podcast, but is that cool? He's got the atomic warning symbol on the back and on the front, even to the edges. But his background continues the image. I don't know if we've got that in the picture we took earlier, but that is very cool, Rob.
Yeah,
very
geeky,
but very cool.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on the iPad?
I'm pretty much in love with it right now.
Yeah, he's hugging it now.
Yeah,
he hasn't pressed his lips up to it yet, but he's got a pretty good grip on it. What do you like about it?
What I really like about it is I've heard complaints about it being heavy, but
mm-hmm.
it's really light. I mean,
it isn't too bad.
For
it's about the weight of a kind of a hardcover book,
right?
Yeah.
So it's about like carrying a book around.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big enough screen to get things done.
Mm-hmm. Nice resolution.
Nice resolution. It's a very clear screen.
Yep.
It does almost almost everything your laptop does. It does things differently.
Right.
But it does it in a very small form factor, and that seems to be it. If you're ever a person like I was, where I really used my iPod Touch for, like, everything.
Right.
And you were always having to choose between, should I bring my laptop, or can I get away with the iPod this week?
Right.
Or my iPhone this week?
Right.
And really, I wish this iPhone was really much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You've just had your prayers answered, because this thing's just a lot bigger.
It's about the right form factor.
Right. It's the right form factor.
Now, I've heard that it's probably a better content consumption device than it is content creation. Do you find yourself, now the laptop obviously is designed for content creation, you know, typing documents and those kinds of things, although the iPad can do some of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can write, I do my blog on it.
Okay.
Actually,
with the on-screen keyboard.
Yeah, and now if you're a person who's bothered by on-screen keyboards, then
I tried
not
it in the store.
Device.
I did not enjoy that experience.
Yeah, see, if you're the person that really likes that tactile response,
I like to know where my fingers are, and I'm a touch typist, so that's really helpful. I don't like looking at the keyboard, and you really have to.
And you have to look at the keyboard for it.
So there's no tactile feedback.
And that is it for those of us who are not touch typist and just kind of stare at the keyboard.
It really works
great
for me. Or if you're an avid iPhone typist, finally, you've got a surface that you can actually type
on. Yeah, at least the buttons are pretty bigger than for my fat thumbs.
Yeah, and it's laid out kind of like the MacBook keyboard.
Okay.
So you've kind of got that MacBook keyboard, you know, distance to it.
Okay.
It works really well for me. I can see if you're a touch typist, it might be a problem. For me, like I said, not.
Right.
And I got big hands, so it's easy for me to type. It's going to be fairly easy to type.
What I was impressed with, just playing with it a little bit in the store, is its responsiveness. Now, I don't have an iPhone 3GS. I just have the 3G, and I don't know if the 3GS is that much faster, but this interface seemed to be a lot more responsive, you know, a lot quicker to go from page to page. Apps open quickly. Just the its sensitivity to the accelerometer and turning the screen seemed to be a lot faster.
It's also, I think, more accurate. It seems a lot more accurate to me, anyway. Than the iPod Touch, but it's. I've got a protective cover on it, and that kind of dampens it a little bit.
Okay.
You can't really see it, actually.
No, I didn't notice
screen,
it at all.
I'm trying to remember the brand name. I tried a Chinese one. I don't recommend them, by the way. I think I paid $5 for that one. I ended up going to Best Buy and buying a $30 one. Much better.
Okay.
I think on Best Buy's site, I wrote a huge thing on how to actually properly put one on. I've put on a lot of these wrong.
So. Okay.
So if you're on Best Buy's site, look up the reviews.
So were you in line the first day?
Yeah, I was in line.
Were
I was
you?
On the news. Yeah.
Is that right?
The news, yeah. I didn't look happy.
What store were you at?
I was at the Mayfair store.
Mayfair?
Right out here, yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You probably saw my son then. It was kind of a wild day. They did not sell out, though. They were they kept things in stock, and it's been pretty positive. So I guess from our initial reviews and from Perry's review here, I think the use cases for the iPad are still kind of being developed, how it can be used. And that's a good thing about a platform like this. As apps are developed, whereas use cases are developed, apps can be created to meet those needs. And I think there probably are some ministry uses in the offing here. I'm just thinking about some of the studies. I think we talked about this before, Sally, some of the the ability to do Bible study, on this is a very appealing thing.
Perry mentions, it'll be great when Bible Glow is on there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking some of those do-it-yourself visualizers, making a visualizer real affordable so you could project your iPad in a different settings for Bible class or for whatever. Remember last week I mentioned that our friend Pastor Phil Huebner down at Christ the King in Palm Coast has purchased some for their preschool program. So mm-hmm. he's looking at it from the education standpoint mm-hmm. that the little guys will be real into the visual nature of the iPads and everything. And then Perry made a good point about developing resources for it is cloud-based printing. And I hadn't really considered that point, but being able to print from this wirelessly to something very easily and efficiently. And he says there's technology being developed, but it's not quite there yet. But that'll be interesting to add the printing aspect to it as well.
You actually can print from them currently. There's apps, at least three apps in the App Store.
That work through the through networking?
Yeah, and with iPhone OS 4. You'll be able to print from it as well.
Okay. Yeah, that was probably
really
one of the...
It really needs that.
Yeah, I would think so. It's it's kind of a captured...
I actually draw on it. I mean, it's the only time I've been drawing in years, but I actually will use it to create some
perfect,
content.
It's perfect Etch-a-Sketch size.
It is. It's an awesome Etch-a-Sketch.
This is what he does when he's not reading user agreement.
Yeah, no, it's a little known fact that he does all of our network architecture on an Etch-a-Sketch.
Yeah.
That's not so, true. Anybody wondering if their information is safe?
No, I do that all safely in crayon.
Oh yes, he does that in crayon. Yeah.
Do a little draw. I do a little
drawing. Did you do that?
Yeah, I did
Very
that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I like that. All right.
So, what about your iPod Touch, Rob? Have you retired it, or are you interested in it at all anymore? Does it have any use?
My son now is the owner of it.
Right.
I reskinned it with a little
Proud
Pac-Man. Yeah, you
owner,
saw that.
Yes.
Yeah, with the Pac-Man skin, and now he is deeply into the iPod category. By the way, I'd recommend that if your kids need a game system and you need to, it's way less expensive than buying a Nintendo DS or something like mm-hmm. that, because the apps are average out at $1.
Yeah,
there's great free apps.
Well, especially when Dad buys an iPad and gives.
Yeah,
gives
it's
you
a lot cheaper
touch.
When your
That's
first
right.
generation. Yeah, when your dad buys new ones.
That's
every
right.
6 months or so.
I can't imagine giving up the fact that I can stick my iPod Touch in my pocket. And the iPad just seems
to Rob has really big pockets.
I do have really big pockets. I will say that this has largely replaced my laptop at work, but it's because at work I've got my other two laptops.
Right.
Really what I use my home laptop. Oh, yeah, we don't really do that. No, the IT department does that. But I use my Mac basically for email and writing messages to people because I don't want to tie up my other two desktops with it. So that's what this does. I write my emails on it and do a little bit of web browsing on it.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, Sally, we should probably get moving on the agenda here. We've got a number of other news and tech items that I think we're going to save till next week. We got some big news from Opera on the iPhone. One of our favorite apps that we've talked about on this show, Ning, is changing their business model, unfortunately. And Rob briefly mentioned the iPhone 4.0 software is out, so we'll talk about all those maybe next week. We should move on to our picks of the week, and we kind of prepped Rob a little bit that he would be on the hook for a pick. I won't make him go first. Sally, why don't you hit lead off, and then we'll give Rob a little bit of time to formulate his thoughts on his pick of the week.
Okay, well, since we've spent a good amount of time talking about gadgets on this show, I'm going to point you to a website that's going to help you find the perfect gadget, or at least that's what they claim. And this site is called Measy, MEASY.com. And it's set up to help you formulate your ideas, as you're trying to decide on a particular device. And, I think all of us have probably been overwhelmed, for instance, if we're shopping for a digital camera or a SLR, maybe an ebook reader or a smartphone, with the variety of options that are out there. And on this website, it actually lets you take a quiz and tell the website what your budget is, what's important to you, how important is, for instance, for a camera, mm-hmm. size of the camera, ease of use, picture quality, how important is customer service and warranty, how important is recording video on your camera, what are you going to be using the camera for? Is it going to be for action shots during sporting events? Are you going to, do low light type of camera stuff, that mm-hmm. kind of thing? And so when you input all these different factors that are important to you as you make that selection, then it's going to give you reviews on cameras that closest that meet your criteria the closest. And they've reviewed a variety of cameras. They have, you know, standing reviews that you can look at, but they also take into consideration all the variety of factors that you're looking for specifically and mold the responses based on that. Mm-hmm. So you can look at individual cameras once you've gotten that list from the quiz results, or you can do side-by-side comparisons of the different cameras that they recommend. And it's, again, not just related to cameras. There's HDTVs, netbooks, all types of gadgetry represented on Meezy.com.
Now, Sally, this sounds like the perfect tool to create a business case to justify an expense to your spouse.
I'm thinking your son might head over here because his iPads aren't on here.
I'm hoping he's not listening. He could probably present a pretty compelling case for an iPad. All right. That's Meezy.com, was it?
That's right.
Very good. Thanks, Sally. Rob, you have a pick, I assume?
Oh, yeah.
What's your pick?
I'm in love with a piece of software called TeamViewer. I think we looked up the website earlier. I believe it's actually just...
Yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes. It's on it's a CNET download, right?
Yeah, you can get it on CNET downloads or off their website.
So what does TeamViewer do?
Basically, it remotely controls your computer. Now, there's lots of products that do this, but some of its advantages are, number one, it will work with machines that are what's called NATed. In other words, it will work behind your firewall, basically.
So is it server based then? Is there an account you have to create then, so it remembers and can track where that computer is and they connect or they
send
signals?
For the whole
model,
no.
Okay.
For the whole model, there's no sign up required.
Okay.
The thing that TeamViewer does better than everybody else is it's cross platform. Mm-hmm. By cross platform, I mean it works on everything.
Okay.
Linux boxes.
Okay.
Macs, PCs, I even have a client that runs on my iPad or, you know, your iPhone.
Mm-hmm. So it's remote desktop. So if I had, if I have a Mac at home and I have my laptop here at the office, I can install the software on both and be able to control
one
either
with the
one.
Other. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or go back and forth.
Yes.
Okay.
As long as they're both on,
as long as they're both on and the software's running. And I wouldn't have to do any configuration on my router at home?
Nope. It could go right
really?
To your router.
Very
That's what's
cool.
pretty amazing. It
That's
even
what
gets
Back to My
stuff.
Mac always promised, right?
Yeah, right.
Except this is cross. This will work
they
out
actually did
platform.
It.
Okay. Yeah, and you've got it running it. On your iPad.
Yeah, I run it on my iPad. In fact, we had an issue the other day where I was able to just go right into my Ubuntu box at work.
Big question is cost.
Cost for home is free.
Free.
So don't abuse it because they won't make it free anymore if you abuse it. For businesses, it's highly competitive. It's around, for three lifetime, forever licenses, it's around $2,600.
Okay.
But that is unlimited clients.
Okay. Just so you as a support person could, control, servers or whatever. Unlimited number of servers, and then
three
help desk people. Oh, three connections at a time. Okay.
In other words, three people can use it at a time.
Oh, right. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So perfect for remote administration for, let's say, somebody who manages a school network or a church network.
Yeah, or poor Aunt Becky who keeps wrecking up her computer. You can get into that. It's awesome for that, too. And it's very easy to install.
Sounds cool. Any differences between, let's say, remote desktop or the Windows version or VNC, any of those kind of tools?
Well, both VNC and Windows remote desktop, they cannot go through a NAT. It's called a NAT.
Yeah,
and that is what you are almost always on when you're hooked up to the internet.
Yep.
So this can actually traverse the internet and get right to your desktop without.
So this is kind of like GoToMyPC, right?
Yeah.
That kind of product, which is made by Citrix.
It's very fast, however, and way less expensive than.
I'm going to try that. I'd never heard of it. How did you come across it?
Playing with the iPad, actually.
Okay.
I was looking for a remote desktop client.
Okay. And it'll work on iPod Touch or iPhone?
It's actually made
for
the iPhone. You just basically scale it up for the iPad.
But it'll work on a regular computer, too, though.
Yes. Okay. It'll work on a PC, a Mac, or even, believe it or not, Linux.
Okay. And you, the control software will work on my desktop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep, it'll control from any one of the
very cool platforms. Try that. Thanks.
So Rob, on the iPod, I'm a little slow here, but is it an application that you install, or are you doing that through the browser?
Yeah, it's available through the App Store.
Okay.
And you just download it and put it on. It's free download, so you can always try it out. If you like it, you can buy it for your business or keep using it for free at home.
Very cool. I like it.
I'm in love with it, yeah.
All righty. My pick is a hardware pick this week called the Air Mouse by a company called Gyration. I think it's gyration.com. They make programmable mouses that presenters use. I do a lot of presentations. I was just doing the one this Saturday. And sometimes it's helpful to not be chained to your presentation machine. You want to walk around. And this mouse is a wireless device that does, you know, all the typical mouse kind of stuff. But because it's programmable, you can program keys to do different things, like do highlights and laser pointing, which is always good for presentations. But this mouse is a little bit different in that you can actually pick it up off the surface, press a button, and move the mouse just by waving the mouse in the air, as I'm doing now, if you could see me. Which is very cool, because now I can use the mouse remotely and actually operate my computer from some distance from the keyboard. So I have right click and left click. If you double click the button, it stays in this remote mode. And depending on how fast you move your mouse, it actually tracks with you. And it has all kinds of programs that you can set up with PowerPoint and browsers, so that you get automatic scrolling and all kinds of stuff that are really helpful to presenters. It says under $100. I think you can get a decent version for like $60-$65, something like that. It does require you to plug in a little transmitter device. It's not Bluetooth, but it is radio frequency. So I think this will go up to 100 feet. Maybe it's even a little bit further. But does a great job at tracking. It never loses a connection, and the programmable feature really kind of makes it an option for kind of however you would like to use it. I use it as my regular mouse, but then when I go on the road, I'll grab the mouse and take it with, and I've got a remote presentation tool for, you know, highlight. You can do highlighting, laser pointing. You can change slides in a PowerPoint just by flicking the mouse to the left or to the right, go backward or forward. Really easy to use. I would really, anybody using it, anybody doing any kind of presentation, I think this would be a great tool. It could be used in Bible class or any kind of presentation environment. So that's the Air Mouse Elite from Gyration Software.
I think that's a really nice find, Martin, because I think mouse technology has been kind of lagging in wireless circles. Mm-hmm. So nice to know that you're using it and are successful with it.
Okay. All right. We got a book here, Sally. We're at the 45-6 minute mark here, and we're not even to community feedback, and we got a ton. So talk fast.
Okay. First up, we just want to give a shout out to John Shoesmith, who is our closed caption expert. We mentioned John in last week's episode, Martin, and talked about the fact that he's trying to round up anybody else that's doing closed caption video work in the Well circles, so that maybe you guys can put your heads together and come up with some even greater ideas. Yep. So if you are doing closed caption video and want to get in touch with John, please let us know and we can help you make that connection.
Hook you up.
Yeah. Next up, we heard from Pastor Jeremiah Gum, who is at Cross of Christ in Liverpool, New York, and he sent us a link to a website called Church Beauty, and it basically has links to church websites that inspire. So if you're looking at redesigning your church website or starting a church website, one of the things we always recommend is to find sites that you like and, you know, build off of their ideas as you're doing your own design. So here's a great place to look, because these church websites have been called out as being very well done.
Mm-hmm. So, and they are. It is a nicely done site. Church Beauty, yes.
Next up, we heard from Becky Berry, who is the secretary at Emmanuel in Lansing, Michigan. And she was actually one of your students, Martin.
She
in
was
recent
at our last final web training out in Saginaw. Yep.
And she was following up on that training and kind of evaluating her own church website. And she's seeing the need to come up with guidelines for their church websites, policies addressing things like what's acceptable content there, what's the mission of the site, you know, and that kind of thing. And she was looking for any sample documents that other congregations have put together along those lines. And I was able to point her to our Wells Tech Wiki. We do have a page on technology planning. I'm not sure if that's exactly what she was looking for, but I told her to please share with the crowd once she does develop something, if she does come up with a document that describes their website policies. And if any of our listeners have something like that, you know, feel free to share with us, and we can put that on the Wells Tech Wiki as well.
Yep.
It's always great to learn from each other.
That's a great resource, and I'd love for more of our listeners to take advantage of that and contribute to it, because that's really where the power is in a wiki, is getting different perspectives, different ideas, and we've got a couple listeners that do contribute quite often, and that's great.
Yes, definitely. Next up, we'll do a quick tour of our Twitter conversations this week. And first up, we heard from Perry Lund. We mentioned Perry earlier. Perry is definitely an iPad fan, and he found a new app via Pastor Tony Pittenger out in Port Orchard, Washington, who tweeted a link to the Triglotta Book of Concord that was recently released for the iPod and iPad. It is a free application, and we'll include that link in the show notes. Interestingly enough, Pastor Pittenger corresponded with me after we made this connection on Twitter and told me about some weekly chapel talk videos that he's posting on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So he's doing his chapel talks in Keynote on the Mac and then turning them into videos and sharing them on YouTube. Kind of a niche that we hadn't really explored in our Wells Tech discussions to this point, but a great opportunity to share the word that's being shared with children in chapel setting.
Yep. So we've got the Triglotta on the iPod and the iPad and the iPhone, which, you know, as you were describing that, Sally, it made me think of the passage, old wine in new wineskins. that's really what it is. So,
most definitely.
Very cool. I like that.
Yeah. We have a new tweeter in the Wells Tech world. It's Maren McPeak, mm-hmm. who is out in California. She's a teacher in the public school system there and involved with technology in her school district. And she actually set up a brand new page on the Wells Tech Wiki for a particular projector, the Epson Brightlight 450WI. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for some feedback and reviews on that particular projector, Maren has added it to the Wells Tech Wiki and just couldn't help tweeting about it.
Perfect,
as well.
Perfect use of the wiki. Thank you so much, Maren.
And if you are tweeting and are a Wells Techie kind of person, we would love to add you to our list of Wells tweets, and you can, you know, message Martin or I. I'm Wells Tech Trainer, and Martin is M. Spriggs on Twitter, and we'll get you added to our list. And if you aren't following that list, that may be something you want to follow on Twitter as well. We'll have the link in the show notes.
And
next up, we heard from Nikki Parsons out in Montrose, Colorado. And Nikki has a really unique ministry situation that she wanted to share with us, had some questions as well.
Yep.
They're doing a lot of Spanish language outreach, Martin, and they're using something called Talk and Listen. I think you looked into that a little bit.
Yeah, it was not something that I was really familiar with, so I did a little research based on Nikki's question and basically what the hardware solution does is it provides a transmitter and receiver for a translator to use within the context of a church service or any other kind of presentation, I suppose, where you could have somebody listening and then using this device, they've got kind of a device that you can cup over your mouth that would make it a little bit quieter for the, you know, for translation purposes, and then people with the receiver can hear the translated version sitting in the audience, yet putting a little earplug in their ear and listening to the translation. They were wondering about different solutions there, and I responded to Nikki saying I wasn't that familiar with the technology or the other options. They were looking at maybe a Radio Shack workaround, you know, to buying the talk and listen, you know, software. But we'll see how that goes. I did a review or just a quick survey of the talk and listen solution, and it sounded like a great fit for any church doing or any in a multicultural situation where their language is an issue. So, Nikki, please get back to us on your results there. That sounds like an exciting ministry, and I'd love to hear how it went. If you kind of go the cheaper Radio Shack route, if you kind of default back to the talk and listen company solution. But thanks for asking. Appreciate that.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff. I'm having visions of the United Nations here and all.
That's really what it is.
Translated.
Yep, absolutely.
That's pretty cool.
Cool, yes.
All right, last up, just a quick mention that the Lutherans in Mexico are worshiping with St. John's and Sleepy Eye, and we got a little bit of press coverage of that this week. Our missionary team has recently relocated to a new city where there isn't currently a Wells-associated mission worship setting set up. They will be doing that in the near future, I'm sure. But in the meantime, they were able to worship for Easter with us here in Sleepy Eye via our live web stream. So I thought that was just a great thing
cool.
to mention. For all of you out there that are considering live video, there is a worldwide audience, you know, that may be interested in the word that you have to share there. And,
yep.
Just talking and corresponding back and forth with missionary Mike Hartman and his wife Rachel, who writes the Lutherans in Mexico weblog, they said it was really exciting for them to be a part of the service because they do listen to a lot of sermons online, but that's more like being in a Bible study or a devotion. It's not the same feeling as being part of a live worship service where they can actually sing along with the
right.
hymns and, you know, recite the creeds with the congregation and that kind of thing. So, you know, besides being a good outreach tool and, you know, a great tool for people that are traveling or on vacation or whatever, you know, just the fact that you can reach out and actually, you know, fulfill that need to be a part of a live worship service is a positive thing. So just some positive feedback on that live video
yep.
Kind of access.
And you got some press coverage for that, didn't you?
That's right. We made it in the Sleepy Eye Herald Dispatch. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the newspaper article that covered that story.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks to everybody for their feedback. Best way to get a hold of us is by going to our show notes website, wellstech.wells.net. You can always email us, wellstech@wells.net. Sally mentioned you can follow us on Twitter, WellsTech Trainer. Did I get that right?
That's
Wells
right.
Tech Trainer, yes. And I am M. Spriggs. Rob, you have a Twitter feed or a Twitter account?
Yep.
What is that, if you care
Retro
to share?
Retro Rob.
Okay.
RetroRob.
And listen to him tweet about his gaming adventures. And what else do you tweet about?
I don't think I follow you.
I think I got you on
Facebook. Occasionally you'll get one that I'm in the hot tub, but other than that,
yes,
yeah, Facebook does capture my tweets.
Yes,
so yeah, be prepared,
right.
But that's about as rough as it gets
okay.
there.
Okay.
But
right.
there's a lot of gaming and a lot of app.
Okay, a lot of good stuff. Very good. Rob, we want to thank you for joining us again. Love your insight, and thanks for all the work that you do here in the Senate office. Next week, we are going to have our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent on the show, Gail Potretz from New London, Wisconsin. We're going to talk about summer enrichment opportunities and ideas. So if you're trying to figure out what you want to do this summer and get smarter on some technology topic, especially as it relates to classroom technology, that is the show to listen to. So tune in next week.
Looking forward to a big announcement about Final Web training for the summer.
Yeah, we're cooking up something else. So, yeah, stay tuned for that as well. Let's close the show with the music of Corbin Creek, their song Empty Grave. Beautiful song for a post-Easter celebration, of course, from their album, Could It Be Me? Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Maybe it is from you.